Hey, everybody. Welcome to This Week in 1920s Baseball. This is your Podsman Josh, and I got Podsman Matthew here on the line. How you doing, Matt?
Hey, Josh. How's it going?
Hey, doing all right. You been watching any of the Korean League baseball? Any KBO action?
You know, I don't have cable, but one of my buddies has been talking about how much fun he's been having watching it, so I got to figure out a way.
I caught a few innings. I'm rooting for the Aaron Altair, who used to be on the Phillies. So he's on the what the heck team is he on now? The Dinos. So that's my KBO team.
Oh, excellent.
Former Philly on there. And I hope everyone enjoyed our stunning recreation of an extra innings game from May of 1920 that Matthew did a reading for when the Pirates and the Giants battled in extras. That was a fun one.
Yeah, we had to give a little love to the Pittsburgh Pirates. We apologize. We've been ignoring them so far. So
yeah, and then we did also ignore a sort of legendary game that happened early in May of 1920 that kind of missed our attention. So let's get into that game. May 1st, 1920, Brooklyn Dodgers at Boston Braves. Remember, the Braves were in Boston at the time. And, you know, games at the time, obviously, pitchers were used differently. Guys were used to going long innings and so on. But this was really a record-setting game in a lot of ways. So give them the scoop. I'm going to let you try to say the Braves pitcher's name because I don't know how to say it.
So I think we have Joe Oeschger.
Something like that.
For the Braves. And Leon Cador. Or Cadore, depending on how you pronounce that, for the Dodgers. Both right-handed, both 28 years old, so they're kind of in the prime of their careers. Looking ahead, they're going to actually both have some pretty good seasons. Not Hall of Fame level seasons, but definitely in the top tier of pitchers for the National League.
And it's a game that they thought was going to get rained out. It's a dark and damp and dreary day.
Yeah, some of the players were interviewed, and they said that when they woke up, it had been raining all morning, and they were like, "Oh, we're not going to play today. I'm not going to worry too much about it." But they went ahead and played. 3 o'clock was the start time, which I believe was kind of a standard start time at the time for mini games, especially on a Saturday. So,
and the pitchers it was definitely pitchers conditions because not a lot of offense.
Yeah, not a lot of offense.
That's an understatement.
50 degrees, really damp, drizzling, overcast. It's hard to see the ball. So, we start off here, a lot of suspense here. You'll see. So we start off here in the fifth. We have a walk, given up by Oeschger. And then there's a double play ball, but he bobbles it. And so with a runner on second, Ivy Olsen, the Dodgers second baseman, hits a broken bat single over shortstop, and Brooklyn All right. scores one.
So Brooklyn's up 1-0.
Yeah. In the next inning, in the sixth inning, we have a triple by Walt Cruz, the left fielder for the Braves, and then Tony Bokel singles. And actually, the Hall of Famer Robert Maranville hits a double, but Bokel is thrown out at home. So 1-1 here, just a normal game.
Yep.
But despite a lot of threatening by the Braves, there's no score. Zach Wheat, we got to mention Zach Wheat every episode.
Yeah.
So here we go. Here's Zach. He's actually known. He's a Hall of Famer. He's known for pretty stylish defense in his day. And he's the left fielder. He makes a great catch of a line drive, possibly saving a run. So, Cador's pitching in and out of trouble. Oeschger, meanwhile, is found his groove. And they battle into the extra innings, deep into the extra innings. So I don't know if Josh, you want to.
Well, just the one line here where it says Oeschger set down 18 straight beginning in the eighth. So here we are in the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, still nothing. He retired 18 straight batters. And then, you're getting roughed up in the 17th. The manager thinks about pulling you, but decides to keep you in, right? Yeah. So, and after the 17th, he did what? Pitched a full, complete game without letting anybody get a hit. So he pitched nine hitless innings starting in the 17th. So 26 innings, Oeschger still on the mound.
Yep.
Cador still on the mound.
Yep.
It's still 1-1.
It's still 1-1. And again, remember, this is May 1st. This is 1920. Believe it or not, there's no daylight savings at the time. So 6:50, it's getting kind of dark. After 26 innings, the umpires, there's two, you know, go to the players and they ask if they want to call the game. And that decision is finally made. So at 6:50 p.m., the 26 inning game is called because of darkness. And the game only took 3 hours and 50 minutes, which is amazing when you think about how long baseball games take today.
That's like one game.
That's like one game. And that's, you know, 26 innings is just about three games, one inning short.
And we can't stress enough, both pitchers threw complete games.
Yeah, complete games. You know, they didn't do pitch counts at the time back in 1920. But when asked afterwards, both pitchers kind of estimated in the 250 to 300 pitch range, which is pretty absurd when you think about, you know, how long pitchers. What do you think today, Josh? How long do pitchers usually pitch for, pitch count wise?
Yeah, well, if you get to 100, that was a big game. I mean, yeah. So
maybe three times the average, maybe.
Yeah. 300 pitches.
So
that is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's just an unbelievable game. And it's so unbelievable, it's actually still the longest inning game in Major League history. 26.
And it could have kept going. I mean, there was no...
kept going.
Yeah. So 26 innings is still the longest game number of innings-wise in league history.
Yep. So both pitchers, believe it or not, had faced each other once before. And that game had also gone extra innings. Cadore had won 1-0 in 11. So, just unbelievable stuff here. The Braves second baseman, Charlie Pick, he made the last out in the 25th to finish the day 0-11.
Mm.
And that is still the record for futility in any game.
So, I wonder what his average dropped by. His average probably dropped by 200 points, if possible.
That is an 0-4 right there.
That's 0-4. An 0-4. That's a week. That's a bad week on that day he had.
Yeah, and, you know, the crazy thing is the Dodgers – now, the Boston didn't play on Sundays at the time, but the Dodgers, they had to take a train back to New York City. They had to play against the Phillies in Brooklyn on Sunday. That game went 13 innings. And then, because they had to finish their series with the Braves, they took a train back to Boston on Monday and played 19 more innings.
What the heck?
So that is, I don't know if you can do some quick math here, but that's a lot of innings in 3 days.
Yeah, that's a lot of innings.
And they didn't win any of the games. They tied, lost, and lost. So some rough couple of days for the Dodgers, but we'll see. Maybe that'll be team building spirit here in the future. We'll see how their season goes. But, yeah, just an unbelievable, unbelievable game in Major League history.
Yes, one of the all-time games. And let's check in with the standings here. That didn't affect Boston is still doing pretty well. We're talking about the National League Boston, the Boston Braves. They're in second place in the NL. I'm looking at today's date, May 8th, 1920. Okay. Boston's National Club, the Boston Braves.
A week later. Yep. Okay.
Yeah, they're in second place behind the Reds, who are off to that hot start, 12-8, the first place in the National League. The Phillies are actually still, you know, playing 500 ball. They're 9-9. If you look over at the AL, the big surprise still is that the ruthless Red Sox, ruthless as in no Babe Ruth, are in first place, tied with Cleveland, who, as you recall from our previous episode, Cleveland was really everyone's pick to run away with the American League. You know, the White Sox still being tough coming off of their pennant the year before. But, you know, Cleveland was they had never won the pennant, so they had come close a lot of times. So, you know, and the league was still relatively new at the time. So when you say never won the pennant, I mean never in the history of the club. So, and they had come close many times. And baseball was very popular in Cleveland, I mean, and elsewhere. And Tris Speaker was like a big star. And so you really can't overestimate how pumped Cleveland was coming into this year. So they are playing well, you know, about 20 games into the season. 13-6, tied with the Red Sox. So that's where we're at in the standings. I should also note that the Tigers, as we mentioned, They're still in the cellar, but they did finally get a win.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah. So the
didn't kill everybody. I'm just
yeah. So the Sox, the Tigers, let me double check what the day that they finally won their first game was. The Tigers lost 13 in a row. So they started the year 0-13, and then May 3rd, behind the pitching of Dutch Leonard, who was a really good pitcher, the Cobb and the Tigers finally got a win. So they're still in the bottom. They're in last place. The New York Giants, surprising, they're in last place in the NL. So
that is surprising.
Yeah. I thought McGraw's team was going to be – well, we'll see how they fare as they go. The only other thing I wanted to mention up top here is I think it's time to start a Sizzler Watch. I'm going to make some sort of like sound effect for Sizzler Watch. George Sizzler.
All right.
George Sizzler had an amazing 1920, and he ended the year, not to, spoiler, he hit over 400, one of the very few seasons in Major League history. So I wanted to check in and see where he was doing. So as late as May 3rd, he was only hitting 298. So, he didn't have a ton of ABs yet, but then he got hot. He had 7 hits over the next 2 days, and then he raised his average to 368, and then he had a real hitting streak going on here with multiple hit games. May 8th, he had 2 hits. He had a bunch of games with 3 and 4 hits. So, right around now is when Sizzler is really starting to get hot, and he's hitting 368 as of May 8th. So, George Sizzler, the first baseman for the St. Louis Browns, is going on a hot streak, and we're gonna keep our eye on Sizzler throughout the year to watch that average rise and fall. It's no easy feat, obviously, to hit 400. At certain points, again, not to give away the drama here, but as late as late June, he was hitting 430. June 28th. Yeah, June 28th, his average is up to 434. I'm just spinning through George's baseball reference page and his game log. So, as late as midseason there, hitting 430. And then, it does dip down below. So by September, it was a little bit of a question as to whether or not he's going to get it up above 4, but had a couple of multi-hit games there. So really just an unbelievable season of hitting. And, obviously the game was so different. Guys swung at the first pitch a lot. You weren't up there trying to work a walk. And so we kind of want to – let's use that to sort of segue into talk about how the game was different, Matthew, how the players played differently and how a lot of the rules started to change. 1920 really kind of is the difference between dead ball and modern era, really. So what were some of the big changes happening that we wanted to fill the listeners in on?
Yeah, exactly. So, we'll get into it, our promised rule change episode. So right off the bat, a big change, probably the biggest change, was the outlawing of freak deliveries, which the wording is a little confusing here, but I think what they're basically trying to say is baseballs that are juiced or slathered on, spit, scuffed, discolored, the classic, spitball is outlawed. It looks like they're kind of doing this thing where they're phasing it out. So in 1920, each team or each of the 16 teams were allowed to designate 2 spitball pitchers. And I think we'll see later is that some of those pitchers are going to be kind of grandfathered into this rule. But here in 1920, just 2 pitchers per team were allowed to do this. And
that is so weird.
Yeah.
That is so weird to think about that. They're like no more scratching up the ball or putting tobacco juice or shoe polish on it, except for, everyone can have 2 guys. That's so weird. They must have the pitchers and the must have fought.
Yeah. There must've been a big stink and they were trying to appease everybody.
It's just so hard to imagine. Yeah. It's so hard to imagine
imagine playing. I mean, growing up, I'm sure, baseballs were hard to come by, at least, in my world.
Sure.
A fresh baseball was expensive.
Sure.
And that was like what the team would have or something if you were on a team. Your own personal baseball might be scuffed up or it might be waterlogged or dark. So, imagine playing a regulation major league game and the ball is like a dark brown. It might be waterlogged and it might be scuffed up. So that's what kind of like the what the
the hitters had to deal with.
And you are right that you are right that wording at the time was the outlaw of freak deliveries, which is that is such a weird phrase.
Yeah, like when I think of freak deliveries, I think of someone like, you know, Dan Quisenberry, you know,
yeah, please.
Just or you know, I'm trying to think of somebody else like Hideo Nomo,
DeColvi,
you know. So, yeah, no, I don't know if it was the windup. It was actually the, you know, the way that the ball was used.
Yeah, it did. It did refer more to the treatment of the ball, the damage of the ball. Someone like Carl Mays, who we'll talk about, he has a pretty amazing 1920. So, but he was a submarine pitcher. They said sometimes he would actually scrape his knuckles on the ground. He really came down low, and so that delivery was legal. I mean, it was just scuffing up the ball that was starting to finally be outlawed by the league.
Yeah, and, you know, this is kind of – and again, like, this is like a transition to where, you know, traditionally the ball – you would use one ball for the entire game. You know, you think about today, how many balls do they use in each game? 100, you know?
Infinite.
They would actually throw the ball back. Fans would throw the ball back on foul balls or home runs. So you would sometimes use the entire same baseball the entire game. Now they're kind of starting to go away from that in this season, but we'll see after something happens later this year, the real change. So again, that's like a huge, you know, a huge difference. A new baseball is going to be able to be hit. It's going to be seen easier, and it's going to be able to be hit farther.
And the ball itself is a little different this year, I think.
Yeah, we're no experts, but some people seem to suggest that when Australian yarn replaced American yarn before the 1920 season, again, we're talking about the baseball, the inside of the baseball here, that resulted in a livelier ball.
Know,
more home runs, you know, stronger and harder hits.
We might become experts on yarn by the end of the lockdown. Right now we're just hobbyists.
We're going to tell a lot of yarn stories, yarns.
But that is an interesting point, especially just in lieu of all the news stories in the past, you know, year or so in our modern day about the ball being changed and the home run count going up. This is not the first time that's happened in history. So, yeah, when you all of a sudden Babe Ruth is hitting a million home runs, some people are blaming it on the ball being juiced. They claim it's that the yarn was changed. And there is some truth to it. I mean, the ball was made differently. And, yeah, the ball was replaced more often. The pitchers couldn't load it up with spit and everything else, and that really started to change the way that the ball jumped off the bat. So 1920 is a huge year here, and both because of rules and because of equipment, you know, and of course because of the Babe himself just changing the way the game played.
Yeah, exactly. I think, like, traditionally, like, those two, the ball changing and the lack of spitballs and so forth, are like the two traditional ways that people would look at the change from the dead ball era to the live ball era. But, you know, so I've also seen some other historians suggest that it's actually more about analytics and more about the approach to the game. And we can maybe talk about that some more in a later episode. So I don't know, do you want to read some more of these rule changes here, Josh? There's quite a few. 1920 really was a kind of a new era.
One thing that I thought was neat was that there was actually an article we found that was written by an umpire. So I thought that was kind of neat. There was an umpire named Billy Evans who wrote a column that was carried by a bunch of papers talking about the rules changes and what the committee did. A lot of it had to do with just like some scoring changes, like defensive indifference for a steal. They, like, you don't get a steal if you steal second down by 10 and the catcher doesn't throw it. That's something we're all aware of. I always thought it was something kind of amusing, maybe even poetic, about defensive indifference, that like the game just always made me laugh as a kid, you know, that just like indifference was somehow part of the game, that we're like, no one cares. And you can steal if you want, but you don't get credit for it. But that you used to always get credit for the steals. So that officially changed in 1920. Some of the other just like stat counting we'll get into. But one of the odd rules that I'm not 100% sure I understand is how a ball hit over the fence, landing foul, like what that counts as. Am I correct that was changed?
Was it the one that landed foul, or was it?
All right. So you hit a ball, hit a ball over the fence, right? Down the right field line, and it lands, it passes the fence in fair territory, but it keeps hooking and lands in foul territory.
I understand. I think at this point, at this juncture, and I could be wrong,
that's still a rule. So basically, you know, today you hit a home run, it hooks around the foul pole. It's a home run. But in this day and age, it was considered a foul ball.
Yeah. Okay. I found it. Yeah. This was changed in 1920. So the umpire had to do was basically follow the flight of the ball. Remember, there's how many umpires at this time?
Two. The first year there was two. So
this is okay. There's finally a second ump.
Yeah.
But for all the years prior to this, the home plate umpire had to essentially watch the flight of the ball and determine where it landed. And if it landed in what he considered fair territory, it was a home run. If it landed in what he considered foul territory, it was a foul ball, even if it crossed the fence into fair territory. So, like, the modern foul pole wasn't a thing until 1920. So my point is, guys, prior to 1920 might have had home runs, what would now be considered home runs, be just ruled as a foul ball. Because if the ball kept slicing and landed foul, that's just a foul ball. Like, you could hit a ball 400 feet over the fence, and if it just, you know, stays fair, clears the what would you consider the foul ball, and then lands foul, they would call that a foul ball.
Yeah, we're gonna.
If I'm explaining that correctly.
Yeah, I completely understand that. So that's the reason I had thought that was a later rule, because I had read something about Ruth's home run totals possibly being lower than they should be because of that.
Well, I guess it would have been all of his home runs prior to 20.
And that, I guess that could have been the case, definitely.
And they also wouldn't count a home run as a home run if it was a walk-off hit with men on base.
That's right. This is the first year where, like, you know, let's say it's the ninth inning or the last team at bat, you hit a home run. The winning run is a, you know, a runner that's already on base, not yourself. You actually would only be credited with a single. So the walk-off home run was first. This is the first year.
I'm going to read the quote from our umpire here. He says, just because this is just good 1920s writing, provided a batsman in the last half of the final inning of any game hit a home run over the fence or into a stand, all runners on the bases at the time, as well as the batsman, shall be entitled to score. And in such event, the final score of the game shall be the number of runs made. 3-3, the bases are loaded. You hit a grand slam in 1919, it would have just been a 4-3 game. As soon as that guy from third crosses the plate, the game's over. In 1920, they were like, nah, let everybody score. Let the batter get credit for the home run. And this is also the first year that RBIs are being kept. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, I believe so.
So that rule goes along with that thinking that we want to. So some of this is less about gameplay, but more about, I think 1920 really, and maybe it was partially driven by Ruth, or part of just driven by owners trying to get that, you know, sabermetric edge before such a thing existed, looking at the numbers. And also, you know, it is one of the great things about baseball is following it by numbers. Not to sound like too giant of a nerd, but like it just is great to follow along numerically.
Oh, yeah. And reading the box score.
Yes. And in 1920, the spread of newspapers and the spread of the box score and the all that stuff. So the rules committee really started to look at stats as something meaningful as opposed to just like
who won, who lost.
Yeah. So that's pretty interesting. A lot of changes in the stats happening this year.
Yeah, it looks like I think we have two more major changes, or somewhat major. So this is kind of a little nuanced one. So if a preceding runner does not touch a base, it does not affect the status of his succeeding runner. So I'm just trying to break this down. So if there's somebody ahead of you and they don't touch second base, and they get called out, you know, when they go to third, you could still run to second and be safe. And I guess that wasn't a rule before. I guess that would potentially affect all runners.
It would count as a double play.
I don't know. Maybe we'll have to look at our umpire friend. We need to ask him.
That is a confusing rule.
Yeah.
I read that also.
And here's a really interesting one. And again, I think this was talked about a lot recently because it was officially in the rule book, but it might not have been enforced all the time. And that is our catcher's balk rule, which sometimes is called a defensive interference. Fielders, and I think that's 7.07 if you want to follow along in your MLB rule book, for those of you that have it in hand right now and want to correct us. So fielders, including the catcher, cannot interfere with a base runner on third base if they're not in possession of the ball, including standing on the base path. So, I mean, I'm reading that as including blocking the plate, right? I mean, that's kind of where I go with that.
Yeah, that's what that sounds like. I would never consider, I never heard the phrase catcher's balk in my life. I never thought about a catcher being able to balk.
Yeah, that's the wording that they used at the time, I believe. It was called a balk. So it wasn't just a pitcher that could balk. It was a defensive sort of interference.
Interesting.
That's all the rules we have, but I think there's quite a lot of things we wanted to cover, just kind of regarding a lot of them are going to be reminders to our listeners, but a lot of them are kind of interesting, and maybe they can give you an idea about how the game is played. Maybe we should have done this a little bit earlier, but it's fun to kind of look at like maybe some of the nuances of how baseball was played in 1920.
Yeah, and this first one shocked me that it went on for so long, but defensive players used to leave their gloves in the field.
It's insane. I mean, I think I've seen some like of those old HBO documentaries, or I think it was called like When It Was a Game, and you know you might see them doing that.
I still can't believe
it's just,
it.
Like, it's nuts.
So you're a shortstop. The third out is made. You just chuck your glove behind second base and go into bat.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, apparently, it was a superstition that you would not bring your glove into the dugout with you.
That's so weird. The game. I did read also that some guys, I mean, talk about pace of play. Like, part of it was like, if you were on base and the side was retired, you'd just pick up your glove. You wouldn't have to go into the dugout. So it cut down on running. But also, like, couldn't someone just bring you your glove? Like, and of course, also, no one wore batting helmets. So there was... there was really not a lot of need to go into the dugout between innings at all. So
you didn't have these like Transformers level, shin pad and elbow pad and stuff that they wear today. There's no batting gloves. Like you said, there's no batting helmets. There's no protective gear. I mean, I think the catcher might have worn.
Yeah, they did. Catcher's gear has actually looked functionally the same for quite a long time. I did look that up way before 1920, the chest protector and shin guards came into play. The really early days, catchers just, I mean, no one even wore gloves. Like, and you would hear stories about guys like sticking newspapers in their socks to protect their shins. But by 1920, if you look at, catchers looked, you know, I'm sure the equipment wasn't that great. I'm sure the ball still hurt like crazy if it got in the face or the chest. But aesthetically, catchers had kind of the modern get up that we imagine.
Yeah, it amazes me that the toughness, you know, some of these guys, the fact that these gloves were, you've seen pictures of older gloves, they're like paper thin.
Yeah, they're tiny.
So I mean, I just wanted to talk one more thing about these gloves in the field. So it says outfielders would just drop them where they stood. So I mean, I'm just imagining like a ball being hit, you know, and there being a glove in the middle of the field, and you have to either run over it or kick it out of the way, or the ball bounces off of it or something. You know, it's just, it seems ludicrous to me.
It wouldn't fly in a contemporary T-ball game.
No, and like you just, you know, like you said, you couldn't believe how long it lasted. Apparently it lasted until like 1954, until it was officially outlawed.
Yeah, that's crazy. If you were if you were a kid and like a 5-year-old in a game today, and you were like, let me just leave my glove up behind second so I can just get it and not have to run back and forth, the coach would be like, no, someone's going to trip on it. Like, what would be your first thought? Is like, or the ball's going to hit it and disrupt the game. Like, something like, you can't just leave your stuff on the field of play. But that lasted for decades. That truly is baffling. And there were obviously, I mean, fewer than you think, but there were obviously stories about games who had their outcome changed by someone tripping over a glove or a ball hitting it. Fielders used to also apparently like mess with their opponent's gloves. Like, you would like fill it with like, I don't know what, like you would just like spit in it, or like some of it was good natured. You know, you would fill it with like, I don't know, the one I think I said ash. I don't know. Like, you were just like somehow have a pocket full of soot.
That bucket of ash that everybody had in the dugout at the time.
Yeah, you would just like somehow, or you would shoe polish it up so that when they put their hand on it, their hand got all black. Like, they would do this. They mess with each other in ways like that. But I don't know. I think it's, I guess when you sort of imagine like, yeah, the overall lack of equipment, that it was really common that you'd be on base or you'd be up to bat. The side would be retired and you would you would just walk back out. Like in, you know, basketball, you just get back on defense. Like there was no need to go in the dugout and get equipment because it was just out there. So I don't think that that's coming back as a pace of play solution, but I do, I do like it. I mean, I can't see it even at any level, but I guess when you sort of think of the overall way that the game moved so quickly, that was part of it.
Yeah, it was such a quick game. I mean, you know, if you think about today, you know, working the count is this big thing, and has been for a long time. You know, back then, largely you would swing at the first pitch. You know, so I mean, pitch counts were down, games were faster because of that. There was less walks. I mean, you know, we'll see later. Ruth, you know, starts to become really the first person that really starts to really get a lot of walks under his belt for obvious reasons.
They intentionally walk him a ton. I mean,
yeah. I think there was definitely the intentional walk was definitely a big component of the game at the time. But, you know, you didn't have – I don't know if you had hitters trying to work out walks in the same way that they do today. Just wasn't that thought, you know. The thought was see a pitch, hit it. And
you definitely had a lot of bunting, obviously. That's like part of the dead ball, the small ball. And even in that recap of the next inning games, you know, every time a guy got on first with no outs, you bunted him over. I mean, yeah, that was just
pretty much standard practice.
That was just a given.
Yeah, so, you know, like we've talked about earlier, games often clocked in at under 2 hours. And, you know, and one of the really big things that I noticed was that, and again, this isn't a rule change or anything, because this just happens to be the case at the time. But, you know, something that you would consider a ground rule double today, where, you know, a ball bounced over the fence, like, was actually considered a home run at the time.
Really?
Isn't that sound crazy to you?
That does. And I do know that some stadiums had that like sort of standing room area where fans would stand in foul territory and the umpire would have to kind of decide what the ball would be when it lands there. Like there was a lot more of that kind of discretion where like if the ball landed in the crowd and the fielder couldn't get it, then it would kind of just be like a dead ball. Say I'll give him a triple, you know? There was more of that happened a lot.
Yeah, and of course, just as a reminder to everybody, we don't have night games. We won't have night games until 1935. You know, again, similar to our game that we talked about, our 26-inning game, most games, I think, started around 3 o'clock local time. So you have, if anybody who's played baseball has played baseball without lights around 3 to 4 o'clock,
yeah,
it's a much different game because of the way that the sun is. And again, you know, with approaching darkness, that can really change your ability to see the ball. So again, I think it, you know, it really, really lend itself, at least at the time, to why you saw all these great pitching performances.
If you combine in the poor lighting, the ball being beat up, scuffed up, spit on, smashed to bits, you combine that with the sort of like mindset that anything to scratch across a run is the way to go. And you can really see here with how these rule changes coupled with the personality and on-field performance of Babe Ruth, like really started to change the game from 1919 to 1920. We're really starting to look at a different era. So 100 years ago, really, this really is a – and some of these rule changes seem small, but they reflect something bigger, and they had repercussions of the way the game was played. You know, when you read some of the stuff about the stats, you know, when you start counting something and you start attributing – you know, fame or prestige or success, which then brings money, then the game starts being played to, how could it not, right? To for individuals to achieve those goals. Like when saves started being counted, that changed how relievers were used, right? You could argue that the save is not a real thing that even exists. It's just a, you know, it's just a thing that is just a way, like you can go back and look at saves from 1920, but it didn't mean anything. It was just, you were using a pitcher at the time. So
it's a great point. You know, I mean, you think about all the stats, even a home run, you know, in some way, it doesn't mean the same as a run. You know, a run is the purest reflection, right, of individual accomplishment in some way.
Yeah.
Trying to win a game, run, whether it's a home run or a single, as long as you score. So, yeah, I mean, as soon as you said that, of course, you know, my mind went to Babe Ruth and everybody wanting to be Babe Ruth potentially, you know, after. Everybody wants to be the home run star. So we'll see. Yeah.
And
we'll see how this game changed in 1920. It's kind of,
yeah, evolved. It definitely is a turning point year. I'll mention some of the, just looking at Ruth. I mean, obviously his 1920 was ridiculous and it changed everything. At this point in the year, the home run total is pretty close. He hasn't, like, you know, he didn't come out of the gates hitting a million more home runs than everybody. There's a guy named Happy Felsch, who is up there in the home run leaders. Shoeless Joe Jackson is also one of the leaders in home runs. And actually, Sisler hit a lot of home runs this year. But, you know, Happy Felsch, who did he play for? He played for the White Sox, too. Oh, he was one of the guys from the Black Sox. So, but he is here in 1920. He's off to a hot start, and he's challenging Ruth for the home run lead. So, Happy Felsch. I thought that name sounded familiar. That's from from Eight Men Out, from the movie. You know, the pitcher Sakoti we mentioned from the White Sox. He was a knuckleballer. I just wanted to mention that. You did start to see a lot. There were a lot of knuckleballers at this time, and you know, that wasn't considered a freak delivery. That was considered a legal pitch. So, just wanted to mention.
That's interesting. I'd love to find out some article or some discussion at some point, you know, how they separated those out, what determined what was a freak delivery and what wasn't.
The batter, Cy Williams, who was on the Phillies and then also on the Cubs, he was another early slugger. So I believe he was still on the Cubs at this time. Oh, no, he was on the Phillies. So Cy Williams is one of the National League leading sluggers. So he was a dead ball. He was like came from the dead ball and then kind of started to change his game. So we'll see a lot of dingers from circuit swats.
And of course we have the young Rogers Hornsby. Right, he's pretty young in this season. It's funny. I don't think we've mentioned it yet, but one of my really good friends, you know, he's a big out of the park baseball fan, which is a computer program, like a game that's a simulation where you basically manage teams and franchises.
Oh yeah, I know it well.
And you know it well. And you know, you can do historic teams and historic years. So he was thinking about doing a 1920 simulation. And of course, you know, one of the things when you look at these is you look at the young players that are going to develop. And of course, he was like, Rogers Hornsby, you know. Because I think he's pretty young here in 1920. So, yeah, we'll have to.
I think that also 1920 was the first year that he played second base. He had been an infielder. He had played short and third previously, but he's one of the greatest second basemen of all times. But the first couple of years in his career, he didn't play second. He just sort of rotated. I always thought it was weird that it was Rogers with an S.
That's wild.
Like some more than one.
I mean, they got to come back.
Yeah, Rogers.
We got everybody happy, sad, slim.
There were a lot of slims.
Yeah, the only one recently that even approaches these, and he was even a while ago, is remember Oil Can Boyd?
Oh, yeah, sure.
What a legendary nickname that is.
That's when I was really into collecting cards. So I have a bunch of Oil Can cards for sure. I was looking at some 1920 cards on eBay. I'm thinking I might have to start collecting some of these players.
Ah, the tobacco cards.
I might treat myself to Gabby Cravath. A little Honus Wagner, a couple $1 million. Yeah. Well, I think that catches us up to where we want to end for this week in 1920s baseball.
Yeah, that was great.
Looking forward to seeing what comes next. And who knows if we're going to have real baseball this year. I feel like I always end on a down note. But
no, it's haircut season. So, you know, I don't know about you, but I am due for a haircut. So maybe we know a personal barber.
I have a phenomenal beard going. I'll have to. It's truly, truly remarkable. All right, Matthew. Well, be good. And thanks to all for tuning in.
Yeah, thanks, Botham and Josh. And thank you.
On this week in 1920s baseball.
Adios. 6 for 1.